Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My dear listeners, welcome today. Today is the edition of the Big Picture Show here live on Radio Islam International and link up to Radio Al-Ansar as well. Given the lockdown limits here with the studio, so I'm on telephonically today. I'm your host, Mustafa Dasot, standing in for Brother Ibi Dawji. Well, I guess the topic on everybody's mind is still the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. It seems like other news has come to a virtual standstill, or has it really become to a virtual standstill? I mean, okay, yes, we've seen a bit of lesser conflicts than what we used to see. For example, there's a ceasefire temporarily in place in Yemen. However, in Syria, things still seem to be heating up, and Assad doesn't seem to relent. Well, elsewhere, there's been a bit of cooling down, if you want to put it that way, of global conflicts. But at the same time, one matter that is really disturbing and that's rising during the time of Corona is Islamophobia. And it seems that with all that we have experienced, especially since 9/11, right, it seems that we haven't learned anything. Or do we want to learn anything? Or are we prepared to learn anything? And I just want to play a short clip by that hit the news surface from yesterday by Arundhati Roy about the situation in India whereby Muslims are bearing the brunt. And I want you to listen to this clip. And then thereafter we'll talk more about the Islamophobia in the time of Corona.
3 more weeks of lockdown, of businesses closed, of restricted movements. But these men are fuming about something else. Abdul Rashid, a shopkeeper in the northern city of Meerut, says Islamophobia in India is at an all-time high. He squarely blames the Indian media.
Corona has arrived. This is what they say when they see Muslims. They're beating us, shouting at us, saying, "Here comes Corona." Is this the way to behave? There is a limit to our patience.
The discrimination started after an event by the Tablighi Jamaat, an Islamic sect, was recognized as a coronavirus hotspot. Many who attended the gathering in Delhi became COVID-19 carriers across India. Several media channels were quick to claim that this was a deliberate attempt to undermine India, some even alleging Corona Jihad. These allegations have also had a severe economic impact. Mohammed Idris would normally travel through different neighborhoods hawking his wares. Some of these were predominantly Hindu. People refused to let him in.
Everyone is turning us away. The residents say, "Don't sell fruit here. Go back to your own neighborhood." The police are stopping us too. They're beating us.
These Muslim vendors can now only sell goods in their own majority Muslim neighborhood. Business has dried up. Elsewhere in Meerut, rumors are circulating about malicious intent. Locals here are citing reports of multiple incidences of Muslims entering neighborhoods and spitting in them to spread the coronavirus. Residents here are standing guard and barricading gates to prevent this from happening. Even leaders from the ruling BJP have claimed that members of the Tablighi Jamaat sect have deliberately spread the virus.
India should have been free of coronavirus by now. But these Jamaat members have acted like suicide bombers. These suicide bombers should face the strictest possible legal action. They should be punished in a way that generations to follow will be too afraid to commit such crimes.
The allegations the sect has spread the virus on purpose are still unfounded. But fear and anger across communities persists here. For these men, their religion has become an added burden during the long lockdown.
And let's get more now. We are joined by the acclaimed novelist and political activist Arun Hadi Roy from Delhi. Thank you so much for joining us here on DW News. I'd like to begin by asking you, because lockdowns around the world have been having disastrous consequences, the virus's implications as well. What would you like people to know about what is taking place in your country, in India, where inequality really exacerbates this situation?
Well, I think what has happened is the COVID crisis. In fact, COVID itself is not a crisis yet in India. If you look at the numbers, which you can't trust, of course. But it has exposed things about India that are so that all of us knew, but you know, it's put it on full display. Just as your reporter was saying, you know, we are suffering not just from COVID, but from a crisis of hatred, from a crisis of hunger. And of course, the lockdown in India is not a lockdown because there is no physical distancing, there's just physical compression. But really, this crisis of hatred against Muslims, it's coming, of course, on the back of a massacre in Delhi, which was the result of since December, people protesting against the anti-Muslim citizenship law. And now today, even as we speak, under the cover of COVID, the government is moving to arrest young students, to file cases against lawyers, against senior editors, against activists and intellectuals. So two of them recently were put into jail.
So given that, I mean, you described this crisis of hatred, what is your message then to the Hindu nationalist government, which is apparently inflaming these tensions further?
It's inflaming these tensions further, but that is its purpose. You know, the whole, the organization, the RSS, to which Modi belongs, which is the mothership of the BJP, has long said that India should be a Hindu nation. Its ideologues have likened the Muslims of India to the Jews of Germany. And if you look at the way in which they are using COVID, it was very much like typhus was used against the Jews to ghettoize them, to stigmatize them. So there's nothing I can say to the government. The only people I can speak to are people in India and to the world outside, not to take this lightly, because honestly, the situation is approaching genocidal, you know, because the government's agenda has been this. I mean, since this government came, Muslims have been lynched, Muslims have been hunted down, but now the stigmatization with this illness has left, you know, government policies on the street now. You can hear it everywhere, and it comes with a threat of extreme violence. And already they started building these detention centers and things for that citizenship law. But now you know, this will dovetail with this illness to create something which the world should really keep its eyes on. I cannot exaggerate the threat more.
So you say that the crisis here is approaching genocidal. I mean, that is really shocking if it has gotten to that point. You wrote recently in a piece sort of related to this, you said that the tragedy is immediate, it is real, it is epic, but it is not new. It is the wreckage of a train that has been careening down the track for years. Whose eyes have been closed and whose eyes need to be open right now in order to prevent what you see as the threat of a genocide?
Well, that I wrote, actually, I was talking about the U.S. health system, but it could as well apply to what I'm saying now. Whose eyes are closed? The world's eyes are closed. Every international leader is hugging and welcoming the Prime Minister, who is really, part of this whole agenda. Even though he tries to play the statesman, he's quiet when the violence breaks out. In fact, the massacre in Delhi happened while Trump was here, and Trump said nothing. No one said anything. And, the Indian media, the mainstream media is a genocidal media now for the passions it is whipping up. Not all of it, but a lot of it. So the TV anchors are like single member lynch mobs, you know, sitting in their studios. So you see what happens in places like Rwanda and the role that the media played there. And you just see these patterns repeating. It's very, 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 very frightening. And here I'm not even beginning to talk about the crisis of hunger that is upon millions of people in this country, millions of people. This country, 1.38 billion people were shut down with 4 hours notice. 8 p.m. he announced it, 12 p.m. the lockdown came, and millions were stranded on the streets with no food, with nowhere to go, and walked hundreds of kilometers home to their villages where they were not allowed in. And the crisis is deepening now, the crisis of hunger.
It's a really important message, and we thank you so much for joining us to share it. Arundhati Roy, as we mentioned, you're an acclaimed novelist, political activist. You're also one of India's most acclaimed intellectuals. So we thank you very much for joining us to share that message.
Okay, my listeners, you've heard the clip that we played for you about the severity of the situation in India. We all know that coronavirus, in fact, we have spoken about it here on Radio Islam and Radio Al-Ansar back in January when, you know, it was just on the sidelines of the media about the coronavirus. I touched on it on the show on January 21st, I think. But nevertheless, the thing is that what we're saying is at the time when it was unheard of, Brother Evie and I saw that, look, this is going to be an emerging hot topic. And we need to, you know, make listeners aware. And, you know, we had no idea back then that it's going to be where we are today. And this is the situation. So coronavirus has started, of course, the outbreak started in China, and it started spreading, especially to people traveling to other parts of the world, and as well as the, you know, public gatherings or large gatherings where people were getting infected. Now, suddenly, India, which was below the radar all along, suddenly the outbreak has become prevalent, although the cases are still very small. And you've heard, according to what Arundhati Roy said, that the testings are very limited, very small, so you're not going to get an accurate picture. And given that if one has to look at the entire overall situation with India, especially given since the BJP is in power, that they are not handling this matter properly. So what comes about naturally is easy scapegoat, Muslims. Right? And this is what you see in it. And according to Mehdi Hassan, he's written an article in The Intercept which says that the coronavirus is empowering Islamophobes, right? But it's also exposing the idiocy of Islamophobia. He says that if anti-Semitism is the world's oldest hatred, perhaps Islamophobia is the world's weirdest. And how else to explain the fact that a pandemic of global and historic proportions, a novel coronavirus that is infecting people in almost every country and territory on earth, has been weaponized by the far right to attack Islam and Muslims? Let's take India, where the spread of the virus has been dubbed a corona jihad by supporters of the far right BJP, and you've got it in the clip earlier, right? They claim the pandemic is a conspiracy by Muslims to infect and poison Hindus. The government itself has blamed around a third of India's confirmed COVID-19 cases on a gathering held in Delhi by the Tabligh Jamaat. Right? One BJP minister called it Talibani crime. According to The Guardian, Muslims have now seen their businesses across India boycotted. Volunteers distributing rations called coronavirus terrorists, and others accused of spitting in food and infecting water supplies with the virus. Posters have appeared barring Muslims from entering certain neighborhoods in states as far as apart as Delhi, Karnataka, Telangana, and Madhya Pradesh. Just on that point, Karnataka, Telangana are regarded as the more liberal states of India. And this is where this is also happening, right? And there have been reports of Indian Muslims being attacked, beaten, and lynched. He says, the members of the Tabligh Jamaat behave recklessly? Yes. Do all of India's 200 million Muslims bear responsibility for the behavior? No. Virtually overnight, according to an investigative journalist, Rana Ayub, right, who wrote in the Washington Post said Muslims became the sole culprit responsible for the spread of the coronavirus in India. And it's not just the Hindu nationalist politicians or mobs. The country's respectable press have joined in too. The left-leaning newspaper, The Hindu, which is always, in my view, has been one of the better publications, although it's called The Hindu, but don't be carried away by the name. It is regarded as one of the better publications of India mainstream media. So is NDTV, New Delhi TV. The Hindu published a cartoon showing the world being held hostage by the coronavirus, with the virus itself depicted wearing clothing associated with Muslims. The paper later apologized for its completely unintentional decision to link the crisis to Muslim terrorists and replaced it with a new, more neutral image. Right? And the story carries on, right? And this is just now coming from that point. Then you've got, of course, you've got expats in the Gulf, especially in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, you've got in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Hindu expats who are, you know, a lot of them are professionals, you've got big business people, you've got conglomerates that have basically made fortunes by living in the Gulf, right? Due to their business intellect and trading skills, which is undoubtedly there, as you know, it's natural for us as Indians to have that. But the thing is that now being, you know, could I say, present, and now saying that, you know, being wherever they are, they're actually now ridiculing Muslims from Muslim countries. And this because not so long ago we saw, especially after the revocation of the Kashmir. Right, of the Kashmiri sovereignty, that MBS of Saudi Arabia and even MBZ of UAE have basically been flirting openly with Modi, right, in light of all the anti-Muslim sentiment that the BJP is expressing. So these people are feeling emboldened to hit out at Muslims from within a Muslim country. Fortunately, as much as we get annoyed that there's been silence from the royal families of these countries, a princess in the UAE, Princess Hen Al-Qasimi, has spoken out. And she has said, you make bread and butter from this land. Your ridicule will not go unnoticed. She slammed an Indian man in Dubai who abused Muslims and Islam. And let me just go into this more of what happened here. This Indian resident in Dubai, by the name of Saurabh Upadhyay, right, who shared anti-Muslim and anti-Islamic posts on Twitter, was slammed and warned by Princess Hen Al-Qasimi, a member of the royal family of the UAE, right, leading him to chicken out and delete his account. The Twitter user named Saurabh Upadhyay had put out several tweets targeting Muslims and ridiculing Islam, which led to a sharp response by the princess, who shared screenshots of the tweets and said, you make your bread and butter from this land, which is scorned, and your ridicule will not go unnoticed. Then it further goes to say, Upadhyay, who has a history of spreading misinformation and abuse of Muslims and Islam, got into a Twitter spat over several users over the March congregation of the Tabligh Jamaat in New Delhi. Now, in the ensuing exchange between the users, Upadhyay used abusive language against Muslims, calling them radical Islamic terrorists, right? He also later went on to draw his frustration of how some Hindus were being sacked from their jobs in the Middle East for abusing Muslims and calling for their genocide on social media. Defending their criminal behavior, he said that the region is what is today because Indians have built cities like Dubai from scratch. His vile remarks and false propaganda led to a fire response from the princess, who wrote that the ruling family is friends with Indians, but as a royal, your rudeness is not welcome. Right? All employees are paid to work. No one comes here for free. You make your bread and butter from this land, which you scorn, and your ridicule will not go unnoticed. Again, emphasis on the point, you make your bread and butter from this land. Anyone that is openly racist and discriminatory in the UAE will be fined and need to leave. An example, she added. Right? So this is where the sad part comes, where you've got Islamophobes of the Hindu that are feeling emboldened from within Muslim lands to spew hatred against Muslims. That is very disturbing. And it doesn't just end there now, it still carries on. Right? There's so many other examples to cite. but we don't need to delve on that matter. And there's lessons to be learned from this. And after the 11:30 ad break, we will talk about these lessons and look at the South African context, which is very disturbing and upsetting as well. And we'll be back shortly after this break. Okay, Stanikul, welcome back, listeners. Well, we're talking about what happened with the context of India and Islamophobia during the rise of Islamophobia during the time of this coronavirus, and lessons to be learned in the local context. Now, I'm sure all of you listeners are aware, or most of you listeners are aware of what's been happening lately, and I'm not there to delve into the details of this. We all know that a couple of weeks ago, a letter started with lawyer Zahir Omar from Johannesburg, who wrote to the presidency on behalf of the Majlis, supported by Mufti A.K. Hussein, to open up the mosques or to have a relaxation for the allowance of masjids to accommodate worshippers, right? Again, as I said, I'm not there to discuss the merits and the details and to do any finger pointing. I'm just there to give an overview and to state facts and to learn lessons from this. Last week, a week ago, the presidency replied and gave a detailed response as to why they cannot agree to this request or honor this request. Brother Amy Dowdy last week, Saturday, spoke extensively about this, and I'm sure you've heard it all, right? However, the matter has not been put to rest. In fact, it's escalating, and we've seen certain developments this week as well, right? And one of it was that UKSA now, before I come to the part of UKSA, the matter has not been well received, right, by the clients of Zahir Omar, and they now want to take this matter to court. Now, taking the presidency to court, one has to be really sure of what they're doing, and one has to have all the facts in order, and one needs to know that what they're doing is in the interest of the community they claim to represent. And this is where I say, when we have to learn lessons of what's been happening in India in the South African context. And that's very important. I, for one, have been working with Islamophobia 24/7 for the past 20 plus years. Right? I mean, anything regarding Islamophobia, I've been following it, even before 9/11, when the first World Trade Center attempted bombing took place and those bombers were caught. So it's been going on for 25 years. But nevertheless, looking at the trend, looking at how this virus of Islamophobia, if you want to put it, mutates and perpetuates, that we as South Africans have not learned our lessons, or should I say, some South African Muslims have not learned their lessons, and those that are following them blinded like sheep are in for a big surprise. And that's where the problem comes in. And this is what we are seeing here now. The thing is that, well and good, you want to take the presidency to court, but you are taking the presidency to court over a matter that is confined to your community. It's a different story if South Africa allowed churches to run, which is the majority of the religious following in this country, and then you take the presidency to court because they're not allowing your mosques to open. That's a different story altogether. However, we have a national lockdown in place. And the reason for that lockdown is to make sure that we in South Africa are safe to the best of our ability and our government's ability from this disgusting virus. Okay? We have been 3 weeks in lockdown, or 3 weeks and 2 days. We've got another 12, 13 days left till the end of the month. Inshallah, by then the lockdown should be lifted. We pray to Allah Ta'ala that this lockdown gets lifted for various reasons, not only that we can go back to our masjid. That's one of the reasons. The other reason is that we have lots of unemployed people currently in this country that have been, and a lot of employed people that are being affected by this virus because they've got no income, they are struggling, they are starving, and everybody needs to get on with life once again. So yes, we want this lockdown to end. But if we are going to be stubborn and obstinate in this sort of radical behavior, okay, by thinking that we are the select privileged few, then we are in for a big surprise. Now, if one wants to equate the situation with Pakistan, it's a different story. Pakistan is a Muslim country. Pakistan is a, should I say, broad spectrum of climate of people of different backgrounds. You've got modernists, you've got secularists, you've got religious, you've got right-wing religious, you've got ultra-conservative, you've got, name it, you've got radicals, terrorists, everything. It's a kaleidoscope. So do not compare what happens in Pakistan to the South African context. Another thing is that we have seen it's been there, whether it's on Turkey's TRT world, whether it's on Al Jazeera, how ulama of Pakistan, the right wing and the unreasonable ulama of Pakistan have defiantly gone against the call of social distancing and want to still make sure that people go to mosque, including some of them openly saying that if the virus affects anybody in my Jamaat here, in my masjid, take me to the square to be hung or shoot me. That's absolutely absurd. But that's the problem in Pakistan. In Pakistan, you've got this problem to contend with. So what happened was that the ulama in the past week had to make a compromise. It said, okay, fine, we will allow this, but with strict social distancing. Something that was scorned upon here in South Africa when it was implemented between Cyril Ramaphosa's the March 15 announcement and the March 23 lockdown announcement. In that week, some of the masjids decided to have social distancing whereby people were standing one musalla away from each other, right, left to right, and then normally you have a row apart, they were going two rows apart or one and a half rows apart. That they tried to implement that rule. It is somebody by, and I don't want to mention the name, who has been receiving media attention for a whole lot of wrong reasons, went and took a video clip of a masjid in Durban of a congregation of Salah that where you have the social distancing in place, right? And while this video is playing on, he's giving his commentary and using profanities to say what kind of, and I don't want to repeat the words, of Muslim Rajivs to think that they can do this. This is wrong, etc. Now, the thing is that that's just to show that at the level of should I say the level of low thinking amongst our people? That how can you allow this matter to perpetuate? Now, as I said, Pakistan has got a unique situation, and then if there's a backlash, it's from Muslim, it's from the government. There's no Islamophobia to worry about. It's within the within the confines of their borders, right? But the same thing cannot happen in India, of course, right? Because India is not a Muslim country. Okay, now coming to South Africa. Yes, South Africa does not have cases of Islamophobia or radical lynching of Muslims like what we see in India, etc. Okay, but the fact remains is that we are a minority in this country. We are a minority of 2.5 million, including the immigrant population, including from the rest of Africa and from the Indo-Pak subcontinent, as well as those that have been here for six generations and onwards, right? We are and a conservative estimate or a maximum conservative estimate of 2.5 million Muslims out of a population of 50 to 60 million people. We represent 3 to 5% of this population. And we want to take the presidency to court. That's how our level of thinking is, because we feel that we are the privileged few. Like in Pakistan, the narrative is made there that we are the chosen race, so, you know, we are not to fear, and, you know, Allah, we are doing this for the pleasure of Allah Ta'ala, and the virus won't affect us. Well, if that's the case, then what happened at the Istima in Malaysia, where people were there for the cause of Allah Ta'ala? What happened? The virus broke out. Okay, and it happened in a Muslim country. What happened in Nizamuddin 2 weeks later? What happened with some people who went to Raivi? I'm not saying that all are guilty. It's that because we were together in crowds, at a time of a virus that is going around. If there was no virus, no problem. But there's a virus, and one of the problems with this virus is to not have gatherings. And we have to be understanding about this. And the thing is that the majority of the ulama in this country took, after consultation with seniors